What happens when a single book becomes so dangerous that newspapers refuse to review it? In 1962, Milton Friedman published a slim volume arguing that economic freedom and political freedom were inseparable, a thesis that contradicted everything the intellectual establishment believed. No major newspaper touched it. The New York Times ignored it. The Washington Post pretended it didn't exist. Yet this unrevivable book would go on to sell over 500,000 copies and reshape the global economic landscape. When Ronald Reagan pressed it into Margaret Thatcher's hands, he said it explained their entire political philosophy. Even Paul Krugman, no friend of free market economics, admitted it was the most influential economic manifesto of the second half of the 20th century. What made this book so threatening and ultimately so transformative? We've been taught to view economics and politics as separate domains, one about money, the other about freedom. Many intellectuals champion democratic socialism, believing nations can centrally plan economies while preserving liberty through voting. This view misses how power actually works. When government controls both your livelihood and political expression, dissent becomes nearly impossible. In the 1930s, the BBC banned Winston Churchill from radio because his warnings about Hitler contradicted government policy. The state controlled the microphone, so Churchill's message went unheard. Economic freedom serves dual purposes. It's freedom itself and the foundation enabling political freedom. When you choose your occupation and spend your earnings freely, you exercise fundamental liberties. More crucially, dispersing economic power across millions of independent decision makers prevents the dangerous concentration of authority that enables tyranny. Only two methods coordinate economic activity: central direction through coercion or voluntary cooperation through markets. History confirms this relationship. Capitalism's 19th century expansion coincided with unprecedented civil and political freedom. Conversely, 20th century totalitarianism arrived with centralized economic control. Can you name a society that provided political freedom without economic freedom? Free markets require government institutions to establish and enforce the framework for voluntary exchange. Government's essential role includes defining property rights, complex social creations requiring institutional solutions like determining airspace ownership or patent duration. The monetary system represents another legitimate constitutional function. Government should intervene when voluntary exchange becomes prohibitively expensive. Technical monopolies arise when efficiency demands a single provider. Imagine three water companies digging up your street. Neighborhood effects occur when actions impose costs on others without feasible compensation. A factory polluting a stream affects downstream communities who cannot practically negotiate. These situations justify intervention where markets alone fail. Yet government has expanded far beyond these legitimate functions. Agricultural price supports, tariffs, rent controls, minimum wage laws, occupational licensing, these interventions restrict freedom without justification. Government should maintain order, define rights, enforce contracts, promote competition, provide monetary frameworks, counter technical monopolies, and address significant neighborhood effects. Everything else represents overreach. The Great Depression illustrates government failure, not market failure. The Federal Reserve, established in 1913 to stabilize the economy, actually increased instability. From 1929 to 1933, the money supply fell by one-third, a preventable decline that transformed recession into catastrophe. Over 9,000 banks failed. Unemployment reached 25%. This wasn't capitalism's inherent instability, but the danger of concentrating vast monetary power without effective constraints. The solution? A rule mandating steady money supply growth, eliminating discretionary policy that creates uncertainty. Foreign exchange controls represent the gravest peacetime threat to economic freedom. What starts as reasonable trade restrictions spirals into total control. Currency restrictions require import licenses, which demand price controls, which necessitate production oversight, culminating in complete government management. Comprehensive exchange controls are genuinely new, invented by Hallmar Schacht under the Nazi regime and adopted worldwide as an authoritarian blueprint. Gold now functions as a price-supported commodity rather than monetary foundation. The $35 per ounce price set in 1934 exceeded market value, flooding America with gold. With other prices doubled or tripled while gold remains fixed, we face an artificial shortage, just as rent ceilings create housing shortages by holding prices below market levels. Only two mechanisms align with free markets: a fully automatic gold standard, neither feasible nor desirable today, or freely floating exchange rates determined by private transactions. Many mistakenly believe floating rates cause instability, confusing cause and effect. Countries resort to floating rates because of severe financial problems, not as their cause. Floating rates would permanently solve balance of payments problems by allowing prices to reach equilibrium naturally, enabling complete free trade without tariffs or quotas. Rather than slow reciprocal negotiations bogged down in politics, we should move unilaterally to free trade as Britain did, repealing the Corn Laws in 1846. We rarely question why government operates schools. Two justifications exist: neighborhood effects and protecting children. A stable democracy requires minimum literacy and shared values. When your neighbor's child learns to read, society benefits. This justifies requiring minimum schooling, but not government-run schools. For higher education, the case weakens. Elementary education enjoys consensus on content, but higher education doesn't. Yet government institutions now serve over half of college students, growing by charging lower tuition than private universities can afford. The solution? Grant subsidies directly to students rather than institutions, letting them choose schools while requiring government schools to charge full-cost fees. This voucher approach preserves access while introducing competition. Vocational and professional schooling differs fundamentally. It lacks neighborhood effects and functions purely as human capital investment. Unlike physical capital, human capital faces market imperfections. Investors can't secure loans against future earnings as they can with physical assets. Rather than direct subsidies, government should provide financing to qualified individuals who repay a percentage of their above-average future earnings, essentially equity investment in human beings. This self-financing approach expands opportunity while preserving market incentives. Capitalism has driven major reductions in discrimination, from freeing medieval serfs to enabling persecuted Jewish communities to survive through commerce. Even post-Civil War Southern states never barred property ownership, not from concern for minorities, but because their belief in private property overrode discriminatory impulses. Fair Employment Practice Commissions, FEPCs, interfere with voluntary contracting. Employers who discriminate often transmit customer or employee preferences rather than personal prejudice. FEPC laws harm these intermediaries without changing underlying biases. Proponents confuse positive harm, coercion, with negative harm, refusal to contract. Government should prevent coercion, but not voluntary choices. The competitive marketplace punishes discrimination by making it costly. Businesses refusing qualified minorities lose profits to less discriminatory competitors. Government monopolies face no such discipline. Minorities relying on majority action risk short-sightedness. Accepting government power here enables future majorities to impose their prejudices through identical mechanisms. Paradoxically, minority groups often advocate altering capitalist systems despite free markets being their greatest protection against discrimination. In the 1920s and 1930s, intellectuals increasingly viewed capitalism as fundamentally flawed, advocating for greater political control. This wasn't limited to radicals. Mainstream economists embraced the notion that government planning could outperform markets. This view persists today, with intervention presented as ideal, while markets are judged by their imperfections. Yet, major government reforms reveal consistent patterns of untended consequences. Railroad regulation became a tool for established railroads to block competitors. Progressive income taxes evolved into labyrinths of loopholes benefiting established interests. Monetary reforms during the Depression exacerbated economic problems. Agricultural programs primarily benefited large corporate farms. Housing programs often created concentrated poverty worse than the conditions they aimed to replace. These failures stem from attempting to compel individuals to act against their perceived interests in service of an externally defined greater good. Rather than creating frameworks that align individual incentives with societal benefits, these programs impose top-down solutions that ignore local knowledge and individual preferences. Freedom faces dual threats: external dangers from hostile powers and internal threats from well-meaning reformers who advocate using state power to force preferred solutions. Preserving freedom requires recognizing these threats and persuading others that free institutions, despite imperfections, offer a more reliable path than state coercion. Every time we reflexively turn to government to solve a problem, we surrender a piece of the liberty that makes solving problems possible. The question isn't whether markets are perfect, they aren't. The question is whether concentrated political power wielded by fallible humans offers a better alternative. History suggests it doesn't.